Sometimes they were testing my psychology as well as my physical abilities. On other occasions, they just didn't give a damn what I thought about anything, and didn't feel like bothering to tell me what the plan was. It was hot and humid in the tent. The pressure felt higher, too. There were no ventilation sources I could see, and as far as I could tell, the whole chamber was being filled up with a continuous blowing fan that pumped hot, wet air into the dome. It was about 30 feet around and nearly as tall. I could easily stand up and walk around inside. That was, if the robot let go of my shirt. Instinctively, I resisted the robot. It's just something in me, I guess. I could stand a bio driving what amounted to a metal spike into my guts, but having a robot molest me? That was too much. The machine managed to get my chest wrap open. We didn't have shirts, not exactly. Legion uniforms were fairly dumb as smart clothes went. They only knew enough to fit a man's form and hug up against him, adhering to skin and other smart cloth. Having the robot rip my shirt open was too much for me. I was already sore, pissed off, and hot. I narrowed my eyes at the skinny bundle of metal sticks. I figured that someone had to be watching. This wasn't my first rodeo. So I decided not to attack the bot directly. Instead, I grabbed its right hand, pushed against its right shoulder, and simultaneously swept my foot behind it, stepping on its power cord. It was a judo move tailored for the target enemy. The effect was quite gratifying. The robot lost its balance and flipped onto its back. It crashed onto the floor with a jangling sound I quite enjoyed. "Test failed!" shouted a voice from a hidden speaker. I looked around but still didn't spot the camera. The tent was hotter than ever, but I was frowning now and becoming stubborn.
"Sir, how did I fail the test, sir?"
"We aren't playing Q&A. Exit the tent, soldier."
I didn't budge.
"Your robot seems to have malfunctioned," I said.
The robot tried to get up, servos whining. I kept my foot on its cord so it couldn't stand.
"You struck the machine," said the voice. "That's a clear demonstration of malice right there. I'm calling that intolerance under mild stress and discomfort. Test failed."
"I repeat, your robot has malfunctioned,"
I said, trying to sound reasonable, even cheerful. Sure, I felt like belting the owner of that voice, but I spoke pleasantly and even managed to inject a note of concern into my tone.
"I tried to catch it as it fell. Maybe the heat was too much for the machine."
There was silence for about 10 seconds. Taking a chance, I stooped over the robot and appeared to be trying to help it. In reality, I groped its chest panel until I found a set of hair-thin wires. I gave them a little tug, and the robot stopped struggling. A moment later, a rustling sound made me turn around. A small, portly woman with blonde hair and twisted lips came in. She put her hands on her hips and glared at me. She was a tech, a type of enlisted specialist that worked with advanced equipment, like robots.
"This automated unit checked out 2 hours ago," she said in concern. "Why isn't it operating now? What did you do, specialist?"
"I don't know. Maybe it has a faulty balance gyro. I didn't hit the thing. It just fell down."
She glared at me, then checked out her robot. Her face changed from anger to concern.
"It's lost power."
"Like I said."
She stood up suddenly and put a finger in my face.
"You're one of those clowns from Varys, aren't you?"
I slapped the patch on my shoulder.
"I wear the wolf's head with pride, specialist."
Cursing, she dragged her robot away. I offered to help, but the tech waved me back.
"Just keep away from my equipment. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to pass you. That's the worst thing I could do. Yeah, you're getting an A+, asshole."
I frowned, and not knowing what to make of her threats, I exited the tent immediately. Outside, I sucked in gulps of cool air in the open hall. I saw a familiar face just coming out of another tent. The girl's name was Kivi. It had been a few months since I had seen her, and she was a sight for sore eyes. She had that classic short girl body, short limbs with plenty of curves. Her hair was curly and her eyes were quick.
She was from the Mideast somewhere, originally, and right now she looked hot in more ways than one. I couldn't help smiling as I ran my eyes over her. She was in a state of undress and struggling to get her smart clothes to adhere to her body again. Her eyes flicked over to me, and she caught me watching her. She smiled.
"You made it through the test?"
she asked me. "Of course," I said, having no real idea what the test had been about. She pursed her lips.
"I'm kind of surprised. Did the robot undress you completely?"
I blinked, then I caught on, so that's what it had been trying to do. "I let it," I said, "just the way I was supposed to."
"You've changed, then."
She walked toward me and began flicking at my specialist patch. She didn't have one.
"Looks like we might not be in the same unit any longer," she said.
"We'll have to see," I said. I lifted up a hand and touched her elbow. It just felt like a natural thing to do. Kivi and I had been intimate on a number of occasions. We'd broken up long ago, but several months apart tends to make a man forget about whatever it was that had pissed him off in the first place. She smiled up at me shyly, but I wasn't fooled. Kivi didn't have a shy bone in her body.
"I passed, according to the tech," I said. "But I don't know why the hell they would give us such a freaky test in the first place."
"I'm not sure, but I'll bet we're heading somewhere hot and wet."
I thought about that and nodded. "Testing how easily we're irritated by heat and pressure?"
"I guess."
"You feel a little warmed up," I said, looking down at her and smiling again. "How about we go get a cool drink before the hegemony bastards torture us some more?"
"Good idea," she said,
and we headed up a short flight of steps to the ring of booths that surrounded the central testing area. Half the booths were occupied by various Legion representatives, while the rest seemed to be concession stands selling things. I bought Kivi a beer, and we drank fast. You never know how long you had before you were caught goofing off in Legion Varus. As it turned out, I was just lowering my face toward hers to kiss her when my tapper buzzed on my arm. I could tell hers was going off, too. She winced a little. The vibration under your skin never felt right. Most of us had them set so they only made tones or flashed colors on the skin. But Legion rules were clear. We had to have them set to vibrate for emergency incoming orders. She raised my arm to eye my tapper, which I'd had fixed earlier today. When she let it go, I naturally allowed my hand to come down and rest on her shoulder. She smiled and reached up in response, throwing a hand around my neck.
"Forget about it for a second," she whispered.
She kissed me, dragging my face down to meet hers. We had a serious height difference, but we'd always managed to find ways to get around it. The next day went by quickly. We were tested some more, and the tests themselves made me feel suspicious about this mission. Most of the metrics being measured centered on our tolerance for irritation, pain, heat, and pressure. Could we take it? The answer for most of us was yes. The Legionnaires in Varus weren't like most of the others I'd run into. We might not be the smartest or the best equipped, but we could take a beating and keep marching on. By the third night, we were tired but not defeated. We were herded aboard a sky train going to the spaceport sometime after midnight. No one complained. No one said much of anything. We were going off-world, and unlike fresh recruits, we knew that meant we'd be in for a rough ride. Fortunately, the officers didn't play any tricks on my unit on the way up to Corvus. We weren't here to go through boot camp. We were veterans, flat-faced, dark-eyed. No one smiled or fooled around much. We all had the feeling that we were going to have entirely new reasons to regret signing up before this mission was over. Corvus was an amazing sight, just as it had been the first time I'd laid eyes on her. Over 5 kilometers long, the ship was of the Dreadnought class. She had sharp angles, sleek lines, and acres of burnished metal hull plates that were so long they boggled the mind. Corvus was big enough to carry an entire Earth Legion plus a crew of aliens called Skrull and all of our equipment. Thousands of troops tramped aboard from dozens of transports which had lifted off from spaceports all around the planet. After we'd found our assigned quarters, we were summoned to the mess hall for a unit-wide briefing. I was happy about that, as were most of the rest of my comrades. Often, the brass didn't bother telling us what we were facing. This time, they'd felt the need was great enough to clue in the grunts.
Zeta Herculis,
Centurion Graves said, as if that explained everything. He stood at the front of the mess hall with a laser pointer aimed at the wall screen. Depicted in blazing color was a system with two stars. One was a big K-class with an orangey hue to it. The second was a smaller white dwarf. Graves looked around the group, and we stared back blankly.
My God, people, he said. Don't they teach you anything in school anymore?
Carlos perked up. He couldn't help it.
Yes, sir. They teach us to join the legions and see the stars, sir.
Veteran Harris stepped closer to Carlos and loomed over him. I could tell he was angry and dying for a hint from Graves that he should lean on Carlos, but Graves didn't give him an excuse. Carlos's comment seemed to amuse Graves. He chuckled and shook his head.
Yes, I guess that's all troops come in with. Heads full of happy talk and lies. But today, we're going to tell you a little secret. We're not alone in space.
I don't think a single one of us knew what the hell he was talking about, but we knew enough to keep quiet and stare. Even Carlos kept his mouth shut.
That's right. Earth isn't alone. There's another colony out there in space. Right here, in fact.
He smacked the wall screen, which comprised one entire end of the mess hall. The wall didn't even shimmer. It wasn't a projection, but an image generated by photosensitive organic LEDs sprayed onto the wall itself. A murmur swept over us. A lot of hands raised. We were allowed to do that during a briefing if we had a question.
Tech Specialist Elkin,
Graves asked, calling on a woman in the front row. My eyes searched for her. There she was, sweet Natasha. Like Kiwi, I'd had a thing going with her back on Steel World, but it had fallen apart after returning home to Earth. Natasha Elkin was quite different from Kiwi in manners and appearance. She was soft-spoken, but always knowledgeable and confident. Her cheekbones were high, like a girl in a magazine. But her eyes squinched up and disappeared when she smiled. She was tall, with a fit body and a nice face.
Sir? Natasha asked. Are you talking about the failed exploration mission of 2049?
Ah, yes, exactly. I'd hoped one of you had heard of it. Nice to have someone with a real education in the room.
I was baffled but unsurprised. Natasha had always been something of a brain and a natural teacher's pet. I had it on good authority she'd once built her own pet, out of artificial parts and been expelled from school for the infraction.
For the unenlightened, I'll explain, Graves said. Back in 2049, before even I was born, Earth sent a mission to the stars, the Hydra Project.
When he said that, a light finally went off in my head. I remembered having read about that mission. People at the time had believed Hydra had triggered the interest of the Galactics in Earth. As far as I could recall, the ship left Earth and was never heard from again.
The Hydra mission was to explore and colonize an exoplanet we'd seen only in telescopes at that time.
Graves continued.
All our measurements told us that the world was Earth-like and had large bodies of liquid water. We've since found inhabited worlds even closer, but we didn't know about them at that time.
Natasha raised her hand again. I rolled my eyes. She loved showing off when she knew something the rest of us didn't. Graves called on her.
Sir, I thought the mission was lost.
That's what the official's story was. But I'm here to brief you on what really happened, at least as much as we know. You have to understand that our human-built propulsion systems were woefully inadequate when the ship left. To travel the 30-odd light-years to the target star system took more than 50 years in local time.
There was a murmur of disbelief around the room.
That's right, Graves said. Even given the effects of time dilation at great speed, we have to assume that people lived and died on that ship before they arrived. Some must have been born en route, and others probably never lived to see the end of the journey. Shortly after they left, right about when the Galactics arrived to graciously invite us into their empire, we lost contact with the ship. But that was partly by design. The newly formed hegemony government signaled Hydra to go radio silent. They were worried that if the Galactics found out we'd already launched a colony ship, we'd be destroyed.
I looked around the room. People were frowning, taking it in. This news was big. It was strange to think that Earth had sent out a vessel to the stars without any helpful alien tech. I felt proud just thinking about it. By their faces, however, I could tell that to others the thought was disturbing.
We didn't hear from Hydra for about 70 years. A few months ago, we finally did get a short message from them, saying the mission had reached their target star, and they'd set up a colony there. Here's the shocking part. They sent that message to us 35 years ago. That means they reached the world in question and have been living there ever since. At least, we think they're still alive. A lot can happen in 35 years.
I raised my hand then. I was becoming curious about a key detail that had been left out of the briefing.
Sir, I asked, what are we supposed to do when we get out there? Who do we have a contract with?
Graves pointed to me.
Good question, McGill. What does all this business about a lost colony have to do with Legion Varus? Well, we do have a contract. We've been hired to aid the colonists. If they're still alive, that is.
I frowned. It still wasn't making sense to me.
Aid them? To do what?
We're not sure. But we're assuming they need some kind of military support. Maybe they have a civil war on their hands. We aren't clear on that. They don't have modern communication systems at this point, so they can't send messages that travel faster than the speed of light.
The galactic empire we all lived within was anything but transparent. Every member world only knew as much as they needed to know about the rest of the star systems out there. Earth only sold mercenary contracts to neighbors within a zone about 100 light-years across. That was our territory. Beyond that, the star maps were blank in our computers. We were only given information that had been deemed necessary to perform our trade duties, namely to provide mercenary troops to neighboring worlds.
Let me answer your next question before you ask it,
Graves said, looking around the room.
Why do we think our colonists might be under attack?
Well, it has to do with galactic chatter. We monitor local messaging, as is within our legal rights. We've picked up traffic, messages concerning this star system. It's our belief that the Galactics have discovered our colony.
Natasha had her hand up again. What if they aren't under threat? What if they plan to produce mercenaries of their own to compete with Earth?
Graves's face hardened.
In that case, our mission parameters will change. We've been charged with discouraging them from engaging in competitive enterprises.
Discouraging them? I rolled those words around in my mind. I hoped the colonists weren't going up against us. Hegemony was already hurting, and I knew that Varus would have to discourage them with violence. I felt bad for the colonists. What a grim situation they must be in. After spending nearly a century cut off from Earth, they finally make contact, and what do? Send out a force to discourage them from trading the one thing that might turn them into a productive member of the Empire. It didn't seem fair.
But Centurion Graves, I blurted out without raising my hand,
Sorry, sir, but don't they have to come up with some kind of trade good? If they don't, they'll be erased.
Graves looked at me flatly.
Would you rather Earth be erased instead?
I thought that went over.
No, sir.
Graves straightened up, and I knew he was about to dismiss us. I waved my hand at him one more time. Veteran Harris stepped close. I could feel him behind me. It made the skin on the back of my neck crawl. Finally, Graves gestured for me to speak.
One last question, sir, I said. Who hired us to go out there? I mean, if the colonists are just starting out, they don't have any credits, do they?
No, he said. They didn't do it. Hegemony did. We're working a contract from them. Essentially, Earth is paying for this trip.
Can we do that?
Graves chuckled.
Of course. Any member of the Empire can buy their own goods and services. The Volusians invented Puffcrete, remember? I can assure you that they can and do use the stuff themselves.
I thought about that, and it made sense. Our Legion had to be contracted to take it out of circulation, meaning we couldn't do any other work at this time. They also had to pay expenses, such as to the Skrull for carrying us out here in Corvus. It seemed odd and expensive, but perfectly legal, to buy your own services. I wondered if we gave ourselves a discount. As we filed out of the briefing, I was still frowning in thought. Hegemony was hurting for money, but they decided to spend some of their last coins on rooting out a potential rival. Since they were sending out my legion, I didn't think this was going to end well for the colonists. Varys was only brought out to do the dirtiest of jobs, and this one looked like it was going to be the worst yet. Fratricide. They could hang any pretty words on it they wanted to, but that's how it stacked up to me. We'd been hired to kill our own kind. I was sorry to be a part of this mission already. The more I learned about it, the less I liked it.
Chapter 5.
Are you having bad feelings, McGill?
Veteran Harris asked me a few minutes later in our barracks. I didn't even look at him.
You do understand you're not paid to have feelings of any kind, right?
He asked me, getting in my face.
None of us are. The stakes are too high for any of that crap. All of Earth, everything you love and live for, is in danger.
I get that, Vet, I said.
But this is bullshit.
Now don't get like that on me. We don't even know the whole story. You have to trust in your officers and your government. Didn't they teach you that in tech school?
I dropped out, remember?
That's no excuse. Get your head straight. If I give the order, I need to know you'll pull the trigger, no matter what you're aiming at.
I sighed and grumbled. Harris stalked away to harangue others. Morale was low. We'd been under the impression we were heading out to fight an alien race to expand our territory. Instead, we were apparently going to have to kill our own kind before they could set up shop and compete with us. That just didn't sit well with me, or most of the others. One notable exception was Carlos. He was positively cheery.
Why the smile, Carlos?
I asked him after the 10-minute buzzer for lights out went off.
You have a secret murdering soul in your chest?
Sure do, he said. Same as you, but that's not it. I'm happy because this is going to be an easy run. Finally, a mission a guy can sleep through. Just think about it. A few scrawny colonists who've been sitting in a tin can ship for 50 years, they'll probably be wearing loincloths and giving each other rides in antique rickshaws. They won't have a chance against a polished outfit of pros like us.
I stared at him. And that makes you happy?
Sure does. What, did you want to fight another horde of crazy lizards?
No, I admitted. But I don't want to be gunning down women and little kids, either.
We won't have to do that, Carlos said. We'll just show up and scare them. Make them think of some other way to make a trade deal with the Galactics.
What if they don't have anything else worth selling?
Carlos shrugged.
No idea. But hey, do you think they'll have girls on this colony? I mean, they'd have to be pretty starved for a real man by now, wouldn't you think?
I took a swing at him. I'd done it before, but usually he'd started it. I think I surprised him because he jerked his head back too late. I caught the tip of his chin with my knuckles, and he stumbled away, cursing. We thumped each other a few times, then began wrestling. I was winning easily, but veteran Harris's big boots clumped near, and he pulled us apart like two school kids.
"What's wrong with you clowns?"
Harris demanded, glowering at us. Then he let go of me and shook Carlos.
"You started it, didn't you?" "That's an unfair assumption, vet," Carlos complained. "McGill swung first."
"Doesn't matter," Harris said. "I know it's your fault."
"What? Why?"
"'Cause McGill is an asshole, but you're worse."
A few minutes later, we were on our bunks with the lights out. I rubbed at a bruise on my cheek.
"Seriously?"
Carlos whispered from the bunk above mine.
"You think they'll have girls on this rock?"
"Don't worry," I said. "I'll save them for you. You'll get to slaughter all the civvies."
"That's not what I meant, damn it," he muttered. "Just forget about it, and I'm sorry I hurt your feelings. No one seems to know when I'm joking around."
"That's because you joke about things that aren't funny." Eventually, I drifted off to sleep. I dreamt of screaming colonists with legionnaires running after them, hosing them down with pellets and sizzling beams. I didn't really believe it could happen, but Legion Varus had done some questionable things in the past, and Earth was desperate. Centurion Graves summoned me to his office at the end of our first week in space. I'd been expecting his call. It was time for me to begin my training as a specialist. I'd have to learn fast, as by the time we made planetfall and I jumped out of Corvus, I'd be expected to function in my new role. Earth's legions had three flavors of non-coms in the enlisted ranks, four if you counted the veterans. As a specialist, you could become a bio who basically served as a medic in the legions. It was a little more complicated than patching up the wounded, however. You had to learn how to operate the revival machines. I shuddered just thinking about that job. I didn't want to work with those machines. Call me squeamish, but I didn't even like the idea that I'd been birthed by them repeatedly after dying. Fortunately, I knew the bio people in the Legion pretty much hated me and would probably veto the idea. I wasn't worried I'd end up working with them. That brought it down to two possibilities. I could be a tech or a weaponeer. Techs were just what they sounded like. They handled the drones, our weapons, and our combat suits. Maintaining the hardware was a big job in a space-going military force. I knew I could do that kind of work, and I had the education for it. I rather suspected they would assign me there. But they didn't.
"James McGill,"
Graves said slowly. He made it sound as if my name left a funny taste in his mouth.
"Sir?"
He stared at me for a second.
"You're a lot of trouble. Did you know that?"
"Yes, sir. My mama tells great stories about my early days." He chuckled.
"I bet she does. I just reread your psych report, you know."
I didn't flinch. After all, they'd let me into this legion. When I'd first joined up, the other legions hadn't wanted me due to a few spikes and curls that showed up on the tests. They'd labeled me a troublemaker, the same as Graves was doing now. And they'd passed, all of them. But Legion Varus had signed me on willingly enough. "I kind of figured that was all behind me by now," I said. Graves shook his head.
"I'm not talking about the original tests. I'm talking about the ones they did before we shipped out from Earth. You failed, you know, with flying colors. You lost it in the pressure tent."
I glanced at him in surprise.
"Yeah, sure," he said. "You had a cover story for beating on your robot. Did you really think there weren't any cameras recording it all? Worse than that, you failed to follow orders on several additional occasions, doing whatever you damned well pleased."
I snapped my eyes back to the forward wall. Sorry about that, sir.
Don't be. We brought you along anyway, didn't we? Really, I wasn't surprised by the results. But you have to try to keep a lid on it this time, okay? Do me that little favor. Follow orders this time out, and don't kill people who get in your way. Unless they're the enemy. Do I make myself clear?
Crystal, I said.
Graves sighed. I could tell he didn't believe me.
Let me level with you, Specialist. I don't know how this is all going to go down. We have no real idea what we'll be facing. According to our estimates, there shouldn't be more than 20,000 colonists, assuming a reasonable level of attrition and breeding over the last 70 years. On top of that, they'll be wielding pitchforks with any luck.
He paused, looking over a flimsy slip of dynamically updating computer paper. He put it down.
But I don't buy these predictions. I don't think we're going to get lucky this time out. We're probably going to be facing an organized and well-equipped military force.
I frowned at him.
How is that possible, sir? How could the colonists have advanced equipment? It costs too much, and we know they couldn't have brought it with them.
Loans from the Empire, Graves said. We know the Imperials know about them. If they are offering them membership, they'll be given some starter cash.
Frowning, I shook my head.
They do that?
That's how it works, he said. It has to. Think about it. How did Earth suddenly become an interstellar power back in the late 2050s? We didn't have two sticks to rub together back then, and if we had, we wouldn't have been able to use them due to some copyright infringement with our neighbors. Every fledgling planet is allowed to borrow galactic credits to get started. Seed money, essentially. That's how we financed our first tickets on ships like this one. They flew us to distant worlds and were paid with low-interest, government-backed loans that we couldn't refuse to take. We had to be able to buy passage, plus our guns and suits. Somehow.
I nodded, thinking about it. The early days weren't often talked about. I knew the history written about in my school textbooks had been cleaned up. There had been many shady deals, civil wars and upheavals they'd seen fit to leave out. Apparently, they'd also left out details like taking loans from the Galactics. So this could be a battle between two human legions? I asked in concern.
Something like that, but don't worry. We should have the upper hand. They've been cut off. They started off with discipline when they left Earth, of course, but it was more like a scientific expedition than a military one. I think they must have a tight organization to have reached the stars and survived. Still, I don't see how they can match our experience and expertise if it comes down to a fight. I expect Legion Varys will win this conflict in the end.
I felt uneasy, but managed not to say anything. Graves stared at me.
I'm going to break one of my own rules, McGill,
he said.
I'm going to ask an enlisted man what he's thinking. I never do that.
I'm thinking that humans should not be killing humans, sir.
See, that's just the kind of crap I don't want to hear. Didn't we just lay out the basis for an understanding not 5 minutes earlier? You're not supposed to think about things like that at all. You're no good to me if you're questioning your orders before we even land.
Sorry, sir. You asked.
So I did,
he said, leaning back in his chair.
All right, let's do this. Let's talk about your promotion and how you'll fit into Legion Varys after today. First off, you should know that I've been transferred, or rather, Primus Turov has been. She's been given command of a heavy cohort. The Tribune felt she didn't have the right feel for training fresh troops. Turov is taking her senior officers with her, including me.
He looked at me as this sank in. Graves was out of my unit? I was surprised, but the more I thought about it, the happier I became. Congratulations, sir, I said quickly.
I guess that's an appropriate response, he said. I'm finally being moved out of kindergarten. No more light infantry, no more riding herd on fresh recruits in pajamas.
Graves tapped out a set of orders that appeared on the flimsy slip of plastic on his desk. Words shifted on the film, and his identifying icon blossomed into place. He signed the computer scroll with his fingerprints. He'd transferred out. I hadn't dared hope for this. It would be so good to have Graves out of my hair. The guy was a capable officer, but he was as cold as a lizard in a snowbank. I noticed my name was on the electric slip of plastic. I felt elated to see I had new orders as well.
"I'm taking your squad with me, by the way,"
Graves said a moment later, dashing my hopes.
"I'm putting you into heavy armor, Specialist. I'm making you a weaponeer, too. So you'll have to bulk up in the gym. What do you think about that?"
I froze for a second, but managed to swallow my shock. "Thank you, sir," I said diplomatically.
"That's what I figured," Graves chuckled. "I can always tell when my troops are sweet on me. Now get the hell out of here."
I left with sagging spirits. The months passed quickly. I learned how to operate heavy armor, which was radically different from the thin smart cloth suits I'd become accustomed to. Overall, that part of the change was a good one. My new weapon wasn't as easy to get used to, however. The old hands called it a belcher, a heavy plasma-firing tube. It was about 5 feet long and felt like it weighed 5 tons. I'd handled one of these units before in combat under dire conditions, and I didn't find it much easier to operate one now that I'd been issued a weapon officially. The plasma tube was something like an RPG in size, but heavier and bulkier. It had manual controls and a power pack you had to lug around on your back. The tube itself was difficult in every way. Just adjusting power levels and cranking the focus from tight to diffuse was a workout. As per Graves' suggestion, I spent my mornings exercising with weights in the portions of the ship that maintained active gravity wells. I did this vigorously, as we didn't even know exactly what conditions would be like when we reached the target world. What if the gravity was double that of Earth? I didn't want to be caught dragging my weapon behind me in the dirt, with my exoskeleton groaning and sparking, unable to keep up with the rest of the squad. Training in body armor was another new experience for me. The light infantry really did have the worst of it, I could see that now. The best part was that veteran Harris showed new inclinations to kill me during training. It wasn't that he'd gotten over our little rivalry, but rather that he feared damaging my equipment. In order to kill an armored trooper shouldering a belcher, you had to do a lot of damage. That would almost certainly wreck the armor I was carrying around. The fact that all of our equipment was virtually irreplaceable made matters worse for my trainers. On my first campaign into space, nothing had been more expendable than human flesh. The officers hadn't been overly concerned with our gear, either. We recycled what we could, but if a smart suit stopped knitting back up or a snap rifle didn't operate properly, we tossed it. Legion Varus, for all our bad reputation, had always been awarded a generous budget of galactic credits from hegemony. Those days were gone. Now that my gear was worth more than my flesh, everyone inspected my equipment whenever I fell down. It was like being ordered around by accountants. I said as much to veteran Harris, who didn't enjoy listening to my opinions.
"McGill," he said, "you just make damn sure you don't wreck anything when we get down there. You're a specialist now, a big-time weaponeer. Yeah, I'm all impressed. But you remember, you're the greenest frigging weaponeer on this deck, and I mean that. So learn from your betters, boy. They're all around you."
We were standing in a sandy pit with scorched puffcrete walls in every direction. In order to operate a weapon like a plasma cannon aboard a spaceship in flight, you had to make damn sure it didn't puncture the hull. The Legion techs had achieved an appropriate level of safety by building up a puffcrete bunker several layers thick all around us. That way, they could just construct a new wall of the material every time we wrecked the nearest one. As a further precaution, they made certain there was always a few more layers outside the bunker to keep us from reaching the actual hull itself.
I took a second to eye the crowd in the bunker with me. It did seem like the heavy weapons squad I'd been assigned to for training was made up of experts. They snapped each component into place with practiced precision. It seemed to me that all the most muscular guys in the cohort were there. Veteran Harris never looked at the rest of the weaponeers. He was watching me. He had his hands on his hips, staring at my hands as I worked with my weapon, waiting for me to make the slightest mistake.
"No, no, no!"
he shouted a moment later as I pushed a cartridge into the base of the weapon.
"You have to slap it in, boy. It won't lock right if you just toy with it."
I slapped, and apparently I did that wrong, too, because he ripped it out of my hands and whacked the cartridge with a big hand. He tossed the weapon back to me. I caught it, but not without staggering. He glared.
"You're hopeless. I'm telling Graves that was a big mistake. He should keep you with the light troops, where at least you know what the hell you're doing."
"Sorry, vet," I said. "I don't know why I didn't get assigned to heavy troops training during shore leave." Harris shook his head.
"Doesn't work that way. Too expensive."
I thought about it and nodded. We weren't like a national standing army. We were mercenaries. Our treasury was based on active contracts, not taxpayer dollars coming from some borrowed government pot. An active duty legionnaire was paid about triple what a man got while sitting on his hands at home. That's why they didn't like to have us muster back in until it was go time, meaning they had a new contract. That's why you didn't push us through boot camp the first time out, right? Cheaper to do it on the flight to the target world and then throw us into the fight. After dying a few times, we figured out how to be proper soldiers. Harris shrugged.
"That's about the size of it. But you're failing at weaponeer school. You don't know how to handle your suit or your weapon. What's worse, we won't have time to properly train you on artillery systems at all."
I was about to apologize again when another broad-looking fellow stepped up. It was none other than Specialist Sargon. He'd been something of a big brother to me on my first campaign. By that, I mean he'd bullied and abused me, but taught me a few critical details almost by accident.
"Harris is right," he said, looking me up and down. "That kit isn't on right. Your exosystems are working overtime, hindering your arm motions. You can't work against your suit. You have to make it work for you."
Harris eyed Sargon.
"Specialist," he said, "this training is just a refresher for you. Take over coaching McGill."
Sargon looked at him in surprise.
"Did I just step in something?"
"That's right," Harris said. "Carry on."
He left, clumping away in his armor. I thought I heard a rumbling chuckle as he went. Harris was an excellent non-com, but he worked hard to avoid work. Sargon looked at me and shook his head. He heaved a sigh and reached out with thick, gloved fingers. He grabbed my shoulders first and began yanking on straps and placing my armor into a new configuration.
"That's not feeling right," I complained. "Pulling the hairs out of your armpits, isn't it?"
Sargon asked with a grin.
"Yeah, I think so."
"Good. That's just where you want it.
You'll get some calluses up there, but you have to have the epaulets riding high and tight. They'll spread the weight over your back where you want it."
I nodded, wincing, as he screwed around with more settings and straps. I felt like I was wearing a corset.
"You'll get used to it. I recommend you shave around the tight areas and apply a thick coating of powder."
I wasn't used to this kind of thing, tight clothing. I'd been wearing lightweight smart cloth all my life. It always fit perfectly and adjusted itself if it didn't.
"Now," Sargon said, "fully extend your arms and clap your hands together. Then do it again."
I did as he asked, and the results were painful. "Why aren't these suits built right in the first place?" I grunted. My skin was already getting raw as I pinwheeled my arms.
"They are. But the nanites in your smart armor are lazy, see?"
Sargon said.
"They like to take the easiest path to forming around your body. That isn't what we want. We have to get the shell to sit right for balance and mobility. Comfort comes last. But don't worry, if you keep moving like this, they'll figure it out and start loosening up. Once you have them trained, you can set them to freeze in the new configuration."
After a few minutes of moving around, I did feel my suit ease up. I was surprised. That's a lot better. But I wish I'd greased up first. Sargon chuckled.
Every new man in heavy armor thinks that. For weaponeers, it goes double. We have such a heavy load to carry, we can't let the suits get lazy. They have to perform at max efficiency.
Around us, most of the troops ignored me. They threw Sargon a nod as they finished their target practice and left. I looked longingly after them. My bunk would feel good after a shower and a rub down with whatever I could get out of the squad's bio. I was sure I had a dozen abrasions all over my arms and torso.
Forget about the other weaponeers. Forget about target practice, too. You aren't ready yet. A man has to be able to shoulder a tube right before he can hope to aim it accurately.
I spent the rest of the day moving around in my new armor. By the time Sargon let me go, I was carrying my weapon at a lumbering trot.
Thanks, Sargon, I told him when we were done. I needed the one-on-one.
Sargon nodded and slammed his fist into my chest. At first I was a little alarmed, but it didn't hurt. He was grinning, so I grinned back. The blow had staggered me back a step, but I could barely feel it. I remembered I'd seen heavies interact that way now and then. They liked to kick and punch each other in armor. The sight had always made the light troops feel inadequate. We split up, and a few hours later, it was lights out. I drifted off to sleep, beginning to dream. In my troubled sleep that night, Sargon had a great time pummeling my helmet, to the delight of everyone in the unit. Chapter 6. A few more months slid by. Each day left me exhausted, but a little more functional. I'd always known that being a weaponeer would be physically taxing, but overall it was worse than I'd feared. Maybe if I'd had a year or two to get into shape, it would have been easier. But I didn't have that kind of time. No one in the Legion did. We had a mission to perform, and the arrival date wasn't going to be shuffled back because I wasn't ready to do my job. Each day I took time out to visit the Forward Observatory, which was just below the green zone that served Corvus as a park. I often found couples making out in the dim-lit interior. I usually went alone, making a special effort to look at the stars. Corvus was a warp bubble ship like most starships in the Empire. We didn't completely understand the technology because we weren't allowed to take one apart and attempt to duplicate it. We were just passengers to the Skrull crewmen who operated the vessel, not friends and comrades, so they didn't bother to explain it all to us. Every species in the Empire held their trade secrets very tightly. As I understood the principle, the warp drive worked by generating a bubble of altered space around the ship. It didn't move the ship. Instead, it reshaped space around the ship. By making space thinner in front of the ship and thicker behind the ship, we were propelled forward in a manner similar to the function of an airplane's wing, which provided lift. Using this suction effect, the ship was drawn forward, which in turn moved the field and caused the bubble to warp space in a new area. The theoretical idea matched that postulated by Mexican physicist Miguel Alcubierre over a century ago, but we could only guess at the real details of the system's operation. Since space inside the warped bubble was relatively normal, we weren't harmed, and time didn't slow down for us. Months spent in transit matched the time that passed us by outside. The passengers and crews of the ship felt little sense of motion, even when the ship effectively moved faster than the speed of light. The one difficulty with the system was in observing the ship's surroundings. We couldn't see outside the warp bubble due to obvious conflicts in the laws of physics. How could you see the shine of a star if you passed it by at many times the speed of light? Instead of stars, anyone looking through the warp bubble saw only a diffuse, splattered light, as if we were inside a globe of gently shifting shades. The observatory was our single exception. It didn't provide us with a real image of our environment, as that was impossible, but it projected a computer-generated image of what was passing us by. The experience was exhilarating to me. I could see the stars, and if I watched closely enough, I could see them nudge in their positions ever so slightly. It was rather like watching the hands of a clock move, but I found it fascinating. For the most part, I kept my eyes forward, staring at the growing image of our destination star system. Zeta Herculis was bright by the third month, easily the brightest object in view. Behind us, Sol was just a glimmer, one more star among countless others. When we were within a day or two of reaching the target system, everyone began to feel tense.
"I thought I'd find you here,"
said a quiet voice behind me. I turned to see Natasha. She was smiling.
"You didn't bring a date?"
I asked her in a whisper.
"Not exactly."
It took me a second to figure that one out. When I did, I smiled back. I reached a hand toward her, and she took it, giving me a squeeze. Then she came to sit beside me. The big chamber was kept permanently dim and lit only by starlight. There were benches laid out in a circular pattern with cushioned surfaces. Most of the observers were lying on these benches, staring up at the passing stars. By unspoken convention, people only talked in hushed tones while enjoying the observatory. I was lying on my back, staring up at Zeta Herculis. It was an orange K-class star that would eventually turn into a red giant before it died.
"What do you think it will be like?" Natasha asked me. "I don't know. It was an early discovery as exoplanets go, which means it's kind of big. It probably has heavy gravity. It has lots of water, which is why we sent colonists. Probably very wet and humid, too, like those tents where they tested our responses."
Natasha lay down next to me. She put her head on my shoulder, which made my eyebrows rise a bit. We'd gotten together in the past, but not on this trip. There hadn't been any time for romance with my tight training schedule.
"Am I bothering you?"
she asked.
"Not at all." "You flinched."
I chuckled. "That's just my new muscles. They twitch all the time." She ran her hands over my arms, squeezing and gliding her fingers up to my shoulders.
"The skin's rough here, calloused," she said. "And your body hair is missing in patches."
"Sorry to disappoint," she laughed quietly.
"I'm not disappointed. You really have gained a lot of muscle. Harris is really working you hard, isn't he?"
"Like a rented mule," I agreed.
"James,"
she said a minute or so later,
"if it comes down to it, what will you do if they order you to shoot civvies?"
That question took me by surprise. I managed not to tighten my arms, which were around her by then.
"I won't do it,"
I said. She nodded.
"I didn't think you would. They might execute you for not following orders. You know that, don't you?"
I shrugged, making her head shift on my shoulder.
"I've been executed before," I said. "It's no big deal."
She giggled at that. She didn't know I was telling the truth. I had been executed before, put down by Harris under Turov's orders. It had been intended as a permadeath, too, but somehow it hadn't stuck.
"Some of us were talking," she went on, "and we were betting a lot of the troops would fire, but not you."
I smiled. I guess if a guy had to have a rep, it might as well be as the only man in the unit who wasn't a cold-blooded killer of innocents. We didn't leave the observatory for about an hour after that, but by the time we did, we were arm in arm. We went up to the green zone and made love under a sugar pine tree. For me, that night was the highlight of the entire trip. Things went drastically wrong sometime after 4 a.m., ship's time. Altogether, I'd spent over a year of my short life aboard Corvus, and in all that time, there'd never been an accident or hiccup of any kind. That was all about to change. I rolled out of my bunk and crashed into the cold, hard deck plates. It was a shocking way to wake up, but nothing I hadn't experienced before. I looked around, blearily, scrambling up onto all fours and expecting to find Veteran Harris had kicked me out of bed. Instead, I was struck by a very large, hairy mass. Carlos had rolled out of his top bunk and landed on top of me. We grunted and cursed each other in annoyance. When we got to our feet, we were unsteady. No, that was my first impression, but it was wrong. The ship was unsteady. In all my time aboard the starship, it had never shuddered or thrown me around due to G-force manipulation. But today was going to be very different.
"What the hell?"
Carlos asked, getting to his feet beside me. We had our hands out, reaching for the edge of our bunks in order to hold on to something. There was a deep vibration coming up through the deck into our feet now. It made my toes itchy.
"This crazy thing is going to blow up, isn't it?"
Carlos demanded.
"I knew it. I fucking knew it. I hate the Skrull. Alien bastards, they probably already jumped ship. We'll sail right into that Zeta star and burn up."
"Shut up," I said, and for once he did as I demanded. "Let's get our gear together." Carlos watched me dig my armor out of my locker after thumbing it open. He did the same. Getting into heavy armor was much more of a pain than pulling on a light trooper's vac suit had been. Instead of seconds, it took a full minute before we were mobile again. During that time, the ship continued to shudder, and an alarm sounded, indicating we were to suit up and report to our rally point. Blue arrows flashed on the floor.
"Blue?" asked Carlos aloud. "That's the evac color. What the hell is going on? Are they honestly expecting us to launch in a lifeboat while in warp? We'll be torn apart before..."
"Just get your damn gear on. Pull my gauntlets up tight and I'll do yours. Sargon showed me. It's faster that way." He grumbled, but did as I suggested. Carlos was a heavy trooper now, too. We all were. He wasn't a weaponeer, so he didn't have a plasma cannon like mine. He only had to handle his laser carbines and the force blades that could be extended from his suit's arms. Less than a minute later, we were clanking down the passageways with the rest of our unit. The blue arrows split us apart by number, and we gathered as squads at larger intersections. We stood there nervously, looking every direction at once. So far, Veteran Harris and all the officers were absent. There were only a few non-com specialists like me milling around, and we were as clueless as the grunts.
"The last time we did this," Keevy said by my side, "a wave of lizards charged in and ate half the unit."
"Correction," announced Carlos. "They ate everyone except for McGill here. He got blown up."
I didn't appreciate those memories. My heart was pounding even though I did my best to look cool and calm. I really, really wished that Harris or Centurion Graves would show up and do their jobs. Fortunately, the ship had stopped vibrating by now. Everything stayed still, and the lights were oddly dimmed. They were supposed to be like that during the night hours, but normally in emergency exercises, they blazed into life.
"Is everyone vac ready?" asked Centurion Graves's gravelly voice.
I was relieved to finally hear from an officer, and turned toward him. "We're suited up, sir," I responded. "But we haven't been issued any oxygen tanks. What's the nature of the problem, sir?" Graves cursed and walked out of the shadowy passageway.
"You've got to get oxygen. That's an order, specialist. You lead this team and find enough for the entire squad. Put your helmets on and lower the visors. The air in your suit will do for now. Just keep opening it up and get a gulp of air when you can and keep moving. Have you got that?"
"Yes, sir. Excuse me, sir. Where's Veteran Harris?"
"Harris is probably dead. Now move out, damn it, and watch for enemy contact."
My jaw sagged in my suit. "Enemy contact? What?"
"No time to tell you a bedtime story. I'm linking you into command chat. Listen and learn."
He left us then, presumably to organize other stragglers. He trotted down the echoing passages and didn't look back. Having no idea what else to do, I put on my helmet, closed the visor, and activated the suit radio. My ID had been fed into the command channel. I figured I could probably transmit on it as well, but I made damn sure I didn't do that by muting the outgoing voice on the channel. All around me, my squad mates were demanding to know what the hell was happening, as if I knew. I reached out and grabbed Natasha's arm, swinging her around to face me.
You're training to be a tech. Where are the oxygen bottles stored during transit?
She nodded, giving me a worried look.
Yeah, sure. Near the mess hall. They'll be with all the non-weapons gear. Remember those little storerooms? They're up forward.
I didn't really remember the store.